Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme that brings you insights into teaching, learning and all aspects of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous editions of Inside Education on insideed.com. A recently published book on education written by an Irish author was highly commended earlier this year by the United Kingdom Literacy Association in their Academic Book Awards. The book is called Developing Children's Critical Thinking Through Picture Books, a guide for primary and early years students and teachers. It was published by Routledge and was written by Mary Roach. Mary Roach is a lecturer in education in St Patrick's College in Thurles. She teaches modules there on philosophy of education, classroom management and professional and personal development. When I met up with Mary, I first asked her to tell me why she wrote the book.
I wrote the book because, first of all, I was a primary teacher for 37 years, and during that time there were a lot of changes in the education system in Ireland. And when I first qualified way back when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, I came out into a very, very large class where really it was about control and it was about management. And I felt I didn't have the language around querying that. I didn't have any academic language around the injustice, both for the children and for myself as a rookie coming out. I was aware that keeping that many children quiet was my primary responsibility to try and transmit knowledge to them. As I got older and wiser and did further studies, I realised that, you know, using the language of maybe children participating and being active agents in their own learning, and I tried to look for ways to create a more dialogical pedagogy. I, by serendipity, stumbled on Philomena Donnelly's Thinking Time, an amazing process, and that gave me ideas.
What was it about how you taught initially that was different to how you subsequently taught?
It was very much teacher talk. The dominant voice in the room was mine. The research shows that two-thirds of all talk in classrooms, even still, is teacher talk, and two-thirds of that is, narrow questions, closed questions. So that children really were only responding in sort of recitation ways or in just answers to direct questions. They weren't initiating conversations. They weren't asking questions unless it was on Will Cad the Gum Dullamock or may I use the bathroom or, you know, may I get my lunch. But so there was very little natural, spontaneous dialogue in the classroom. There was plenty outside of the classroom, or at break times, or maybe during art. But even then, I think back in those days, we wanted them silent, even when they were doing things like art. That was the model.
So if that was the model that applied to Mary when she began teaching, what happened to cause her to question this model? Was there a moment when she thought there might be a different way to teach?
I don't know that there was any one moment. I think it was a dawning realisation. I'm a reader, and I would have read a lot of books about education. I know I read An Experiment in Education by Sybil Marshall, who was a lady who worked during the war with very limited resources, and I was fascinated with what she was able to achieve in an earlier era than my teaching era. I also read Teacher by Sylvia Ashton Warner, so I was influenced by these ideas. I don't think there was a single moment. It was a dawning realisation. We were also talking about the 70s and 80s, where there was more emphasis on a child-centred curriculum. The 71 curriculum had just come in when I started teaching. So, you know, those ideas of constructivist ways of learning were coming about. They were in the air. You know, there was a movement towards child-centred approaches. Now, we probably did get it in our theory about Rousseau and Dewey, but I don't think trainee teachers can take in the theory until they've had a chance to do some real practice.
So then you came across the work of Philomena Donnelly in Philosophy for Children.
Yes.
What was it that struck you about that work?
I thought, this is it, you know, this is just amazing. And I attended one of her summer in service courses and just was totally captivated, totally hooked, said, this is it, this is what I have been looking for. And that opened up then the literatures around Lippmann's P4C, Philosophy for Children, and all of those ideas, you know. And I was quite happy to use Philomena's model. It was taking those American philosophy for children ideas and adapting them with Professor Joe Don to an Irish classroom setting. And it was just, there was no end product looked for, just better thinking. That's all you were looking for. You weren't coming, trying to find a closed single answer or a single truth. So it could be a poem, a picture, whatever. It could be the stimulus, and you just let the children talk. The very difficult bit was that I had to be silent. I found that incredibly difficult.
And some people would say, Mary, that philosophy is not a subject on the curriculum. So how did you integrate it into your teaching?
There's an old cliche that every child is a natural philosopher. I totally subscribe to that theory, because I have seen how deeply children as young, you know, preschool children can think, and how searching their questions can be, and how curious. It was that I wanted to kind of channel that curiosity and that natural instinct to ask open-ended, what if, I wonder why questions. And the pleasure and the fun and the complete and utter happiness that children showed, you know, they demonstrated in their body language. And even in the follow-up questions, like, can we do that again soon? You know, because I was still in the old teacher mode, putting a corral around this and saying, we'll do this every Wednesday, but now back into, you know, teacher-centred, kind of dominant teacher voice. But bit by bit, I realised I couldn't put a fence around it. It crept into everything. Teacher, I can tell you, three more ways you can do that sum. You know, I disagree with the way you're doing, because we had taught them the language of I disagree with because and I agree with because. And now it was popping up in religion. It was popping up in maths. It was, this is very woolly thinking in this textbook, you know. So it was great.
If you say that children are natural philosophers, what do they learn from asking and answering these kinds of questions in class?
What they learn is, they learn that there's more than one point of view. They learn that in Irish we'd say ní neart go cur le chéile, that, you know, I think there's a phrase someplace, thinking with one big head. You know, Joanne Haynes, or Karen Morris maybe had used that, that we're thinking with one big head, that we're pooling our ygeas, we're learning from each other. It's very Vygotskian. You know, it really is, that the children can act as more knowledgeable others for each other. They learn new language. They learn new ideas, new ways of maybe interpreting a story or a book. They learn respect for each other. They learn social behaviours. There are so many unintended and unplanned learning outcomes, both in the affective and in the cognitive domain.
And in your own writing, you talk more about critical thinking than philosophy for children. So can you say, what is the connection between those two?
Well, I think to be a philosopher or to philosophize, you have to involve yourself in critical thinking. And it is, I suppose, first of all, about thinking for yourself. It's not just receiving passively the opinions and the thoughts of others. It's about looking at something from several, as many points of view as you can, and then making up, evaluating and making up your own mind. And that's pure philosophy. I mean, that's what philosophers have to do. And it's being open to the ideas of others. You know, Dewey called the reflective practitioner, the characteristics of a reflective practitioner, he defined them as open-mindedness, wholeheartedness, and intellectual responsibility. I would say they're the traits of a philosopher. They're the traits of a critical thinker. So I suppose critical thinking is one of the skills that a philosopher has to have, but also one of the ways of being of a philosopher.
And is there then a resolution to critical thinking in the classroom?
In the model I call my approach, critical thinking and book talk, we're not looking for a resolution. We actually probably set up more questions than we do answers. It's, you know, it's about exploration. It's about digging deep. It's about going underneath the surface, the intended meanings, maybe the ideology, although I wouldn't use that particular word with very young children. But what are the covert and overt messages being transmitted? What's the point of view of the author? If possible, what does he want us, or what does she want us to think? And also the illustrator, how are they tweaking our thoughts and our emotions about possibly a character or a setting? It's exploring those. There's no real end point. I'm not just taking a single aspect of literacy, like today we're going to look at character. We do that in other literacy lessons. The critical thinking and book talk time is just completely for open-ended discussion about the book that begins with possibly with a child's question or a child's observation or statement.
And is it done completely through discussion then and through oral language rather than through written language?
Yes. I think the death knell, in terms of, put yourself in the mind of an 8 or 9 year old child. You know, I did a whole discussion with my third class at one point on why did they like this work so much. And the boys in particular came up with the idea that it's a DOS, because you're not using a pencil. Anything, you know, art is a DOS, PE is a DOS, dancing, singing, they're all DOSes according to them. Now, what they actually mean is that it's enjoyable, there's no pressure, there's no product being looked for, you're not being judged. They don't see it as real school or ordinary school. So what I'm saying is to then introduce immediately a written exercise and they go, oh no, we're back to work. You know, so it would kill it, because the next time you'd go to do the discussion, in their heads they think this is going to be followed by work. And they love the open-ended. It's very relaxed, but it's very intense at the same time. They're all waiting intently, listening intently. They're developing huge active learning skills when they're doing this. So it's hard work, but they don't see it as hard work.
I then noted to Mary that critical thinking is one half of her work and that the other half is the picture books. However, Mary differentiates between an illustrated book and a picture book, so I asked her to explain the difference.
Let's take a Harry Potter book. If which there is now an illustrated version of a Harry Potter book out, if the Harry Potter stories now have pictures going with them, in the same way that some of the Roald Dahl books had lovely Quentin Blake illustrations, a child could still enjoy the story and fully understand the story. The pictures are there almost as an addition. In a real picture book, a sophisticated picture book, we'll take Rosie's Walk as an example. The pictures and the story can almost tell two different parallel stories. There are things in the picture that are not in the text. There are things in the text that are not in the picture. And they complement, they interweave and intermingle. And you need one to tell the other. So the example of Rosie's Walk, the text is, Rosie the hen went for a walk across the field, around the farmyard, around the hay, whatever it is. It's all one sentence. What you don't hear in that text is that there's a fox behind Rosie. And Rosie is walking blithely on her way with, some people say, a knowing look. And the fox is encountering all sorts of misfortunes and slapstick comedy behind her. And she gets back in time for her dinner. The fox, meanwhile, is being chased away by a swarm of bees. There's an amazing story going on in those pictures that children love. Margaret Meek called it, the child can become the teller and the told. They're almost in league with the author against you, the adult who's reading the story to them. They know stuff that you obviously don't know because you've just read those words. So a good picture book is a complex interplay between pictures and words. Both are equally necessary. But you can have wordless picture or textless picture books. They're not wordless because there's loads of dialogue around them. But you can have a picture book that's just all pictures. And, you know, that's another amazing resource for doing critical thinking as well.
Yeah. Now, you build what you call book talk around the picture book. What is book talk exactly?
Well, I'll tell you what it's not. It's not picking up any old picture book out of your library and saying, right, I'm going to read this to you now and we'll have a chat about it. It's not that. It's taking time, first of all. The teacher must take time to really resource and research a good picture book, a picture book that she feels has potential for dialogue and discussion and open-ended exploration and a myriad of possible meanings. And then preparing that in some way, what I would do is scan the pictures and have them on a whiteboard rather than to have a group of children all trying to see a smallish picture. And as I read the story, I will read the story right through. And as I read the story, there might be time if the children want to pause and talk. But some children get frustrated by that. They want to get to the end of the book first. But anyway, so we've got to the end of the story. I seat the children in a semicircle so that they can all see the board initially and see the pictures. And then we close that circle and I just say, who'd like to start? Now, children, initially, it can be very slow getting them into this habit of volunteering. But depending on the pedagogical relationship with you have with your class and also how well you know them, there's generally no problem. Now, I then take Philomena Donnelly's model of the tip around. You touch the child beside you, and that child then has the power to, or the choice, to speak or not speak. And some children need processing time. And then they, if they don't want to speak, they just tip the child beside them. And it goes around. At the end of one full circuit, we give an opportunity to the children who didn't speak to now put in, if they wish to comment or make a statement of some kind or ask a question. And then maybe another circuit, depending on the time, depending on the mood. And sometimes it falls flat in its face. It's, you know, the children say, nah, that was boring. And, you know, then you can deconstruct. What happened? Why was that? What went wrong?
And yeah. During the tip around, what is the teacher's role? Does the teacher, say, amplify any answers or agree or disagree with them?
Generally, no. If possible, you wait for your turn. It's kind of like cheating, I feel. You know, the children get used to this model and it's very empowering for them. And the only teacher's role, I would imagine, would be if there's, you know, something that you need to intervene in, maybe a health and safety issue of somebody, you know, sitting on the back two legs of their chair or something. But otherwise, I would advise teachers to be quiet and wait for their turn. And then if they feel it's just been a bit banal and maybe I like the bit where he did this and I like the bit where he did that, well, the teacher can then ask another question, maybe a more probing question. There's no guarantee, though, that the children will actually try and answer it. They might keep going with the way they want to go. But over a year, over a school year, or over the 8 school years, if this starts in junior infants, you have very sophisticated, deep thinking children in sixth class if they've been doing this even once a week, every week since they were in junior infants. You know, so I don't intervene. And there are dilemmas around that. I have a colleague, and I hope she'll forgive me for telling the anecdote on air, but I won't name her. But she had a situation where they were discussing rainbows. And the child said, well, there was a rainbow in the puddle. And there's often a dominant child in the class who tends to know everything. So this child pronounced, well, it's very simple. It's all part of the water cycle. You know, the sun shines on the puddle, sucks up. The wind and the sun suck up the water. It goes up in the sky. It falls back down again. It makes new puddles. That whole process is called constipation. Now, the dilemma there for a teacher is, do you let that hang in the air? And every child now thinking, because they always believe this dominant child, that this is the word. So what my colleague did was she quickly intervened at the end, said, well done on using those big words, precipitation, condensation, evaporation. And, you know, that she took it, the teaching model, and took her role seriously and did not let the children go out the door with the incorrect word. So there is that intervention maybe needed.
And if a child says something, you know, outrageous, like that just isn't true, I mean, like that constipation example, or like something else, do the children ever question each other or ask others to justify what they've said?
They do, yeah. And but that comes with a bit of time. You know, they don't do that immediately, but they will say, no, you're wrong, or I disagree. We try and use the courteous language with, I disagree with you because, or I agree. But they do pick each other up on. And again, you know, you have children who may be sometimes in what Bernstein would call restricted code language. You have children who are very easily able to pick up these proper terms. For I'll give you another instance, I can give you a counter instance, or I can give you another example, or you're just taking one idea, there's another way of looking at that. But it's not in an accusatory way, it's a collaborative way, or, you know, I'll share my thinking with you. Yes, they do pick up and they do contradict each other, but that's part of the process of setting it up, would be that we agree this language. There are negotiations around what behaviour will be tolerated and what kind of agreement and disagreement and how to do this courteously. And I suppose we're really encouraging the children to separate the person from what's being said and not just agreeing with your friends and disagreeing with the people you're having the row with out in the yard. The thing is, though, Sean, there's probably no strong scientific research to prove this. This is what a lot of teachers have found, that there's a nicer dynamic in the class, a nicer bond, a nicer pedagogical relationship, a more equitable one.
Yeah. And So, and so apart from that, there's no kind of formal rules then during the discussion?
The formal rules would be attentive listening, careful, courteous, attentive listening, one voice at a time. Courteous response, I agree with because, or I disagree, or I partly agree. And you will get children in a class of maybe 30 saying, I agree with John and Mary and Joan, and I kind of agree with Kathy and Peter. And this is phenomenal. You say, what attentive listening has happened here? So that's really important, that we listen carefully, we agree and disagree with politeness, we don't interrupt, and we, you know, they're the basic rules. We're quiet when other people are speaking.
How do you assess if the children are thinking critically?
I suppose, well, in my own master's, I was looking for evidence of, are they philosophizing? So are they using open-ended, I wonder if, I wonder why, or what if, or maybe, or perhaps, almost, but not quite, syllogisms, but, you know, if, then, maybe that, or maybe not. You know, that kind of open-ended language, that they're not just trying to give you, here's the answer, this is it, you know, this is the truth for all time. So are they able to take on board, say, in two rounds of a circle, have they developed their point in some way from the first utterance that they made? Have they changed their mind? Have they developed a stronger or a more tentative point of view? I don't actually set evaluative rubrics to say this is, you know, I don't do that. But over a period of a few weeks, I can often see the development of a child's thinking.
So what kind of preparation does a teacher need to do in order to organise a lesson around book talk and critical thinking?
First of all, you need a good resource bank of picture books. And you need to be very familiar with the picture books and be able to select those that you think will lead to a rich discussion. And that won't happen overnight. That takes a bit of work. If you're lucky enough to have a well-resourced school library, you're very in a good position. But if there is a local library, they can be extremely supportive in that way as well. So that's the first bit of preparation, is to have a bank of books. Now, you don't necessarily say this is for infants and this is for sixth, because a book that can be discussed with infants can also be discussed with sixth class and with secondary pupils, because they'll all take their own levels of meanings. Picture books are not just for infants. They are not. They are so sophisticated. In fact, there are picture books you couldn't possibly read in an infant class. Armin Greder's The Island would be an example. There are books about the Holocaust. There are, you know, there are extremely sophisticated adult-type topics in some picture books that you wouldn't even do in a primary school. You know, there's a quite controversial picture books about death and separation. You know, they're amazingly sophisticated topics. Transgender, all of that. Before you embark on trying to do this kind of work in a classroom, you either talk to somebody who already has some experience in it. I could say you could read my book because I'm giving you loads of examples, and I will say it because it is a resource. You also need to take some time to get to know your class. It helps to know everybody's name. So the first day of school wouldn't be a great way to do it, you know. So the children need to be able to negotiate the rules. So that's a bit of groundwork that has to be done. So with very young children, I wouldn't launch into doing a story straight away. I'd maybe read stories and get them into the habit of discussing the story in the ordinary classroom layout before putting them into the formal circle. But then maybe to give them the habit of the tip around and that bit of work, I might just start with, you know, what's your favourite colour and why? Or something simple like this, that each person gets that little bit of a habit of learning to listen to each other. And can you remember what did Mary say, and what was John's favourite colour? It's incredible what they will remember, you know, in terms of what other children said. Which kind of makes you think that this work has meaning and relevance for children. So the preparation is get to know the picture books, get to know the children, establish some rules of behaviour negotiated with the children, and revisit those. And they're the golden rules of, you know, listen courteously, listen with respect, don't interrupt other people, be nice.
And your own book, Mary, Developing Children's Critical Thinking Through Picture Books, it was highly commended in the Academic Awards earlier this year of the United Kingdom Literacy Association. What kind of feedback have you got from teachers in general about it?
Yeah, that was an amazing joy, and I was quite humbled by it. The feedback was that it was a nice marriage of theory and practice. Everybody speaks about the dialogue, that the children's own voices are in the book, because I was researching what children were saying from 1996 onwards. I kept diaries and I kept transcripts and recordings with permission. And so I have a very rich database. I've saved loads and loads of tapes that I haven't transcribed. So that was one thing. The feedback the teachers said, they saw there isn't any one template here. There are these rules that we spoke about. Then there's the case of you must adapt this to your own setting, because if you're a multi-class or a single class, and they liked that freedom. They liked, as I said, the voices of the children. And the marriage, they said the interweaving throughout of the research, the recommended reading, you know, that some of the work was done for them, and the lists of picture books. And then in the appendices, I have lists of picture books around different topics, which was helpful. And also recommended picture books, you know, for there are hundreds of them listed there. They liked the idea too of sample questions, because that was one thing I struggled with initially. I was just amazed by the great questions some teachers could come up with. I wasn't a critical thinker back in the day at all, and I just couldn't imagine, how did you think of that? It's an amazing question. How did you think of that? But it's like riding a bike. The more you do it, the better you get at it. And like reading, Margaret Meek said, children learn to read by reading, not about talking about reading, you know, doing it. And so you get better at asking questions. But I do have sample questions in there as well for teachers of, you know, story starters or not a template, not a model, just an approach that you can tweak and adapt to your own setting. That's what teachers liked generally. People on the literacy theory end liked the fact that I did access a lot of the theory and try and pull together the most recent work on comprehension, for example, on oral language, on critical thinking, and on read-alouds, interactive read-alouds. It's that part was commented on as well.
Mary Roach is the author of Developing Children's Critical Thinking Through Picture Books, a guide for primary and early years students and teachers. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with the programme by writing to me with feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.